Welcome to the First Intuition Podcast. On this episode, we talk everything football and finance related with Kieran Maguire. As always, we recorded the session in front of a live Zoom audience, and if you'd like to attend a future session, please look for the registration link in the show notes. Well, hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the First Intuition Podcast. I am Ben Borman, tutor and director at First Intuition. I am joined, as always, by my good friend and colleague, David Malthouse. Good evening, Dave.
Evening, Ben. And how are you enjoying the Euros this week?
I am absolutely loving the football. Obviously, podcast listeners might be listening to this at a future point in time where England and Wales are no longer in the competition. But as we're recording, both are through to the knockout rounds, and we are anticipating the game tonight that will decide who England play in the next round. So super excited about that. And the good news is the next game is scheduled for Tuesday, and I'm not down to do any evening teaching until the Wednesday, which is brilliant.
That is good news. But alternatively, someone in the future is, you know, going running with their dog in August, and they're listening back thinking, oh, how pessimistic Ben was. Of course, it was a Wales-England final, and England then went on to win. I don't even know if the draw allows for that to actually be a fixture in the end. So, I'm always going into these tournaments really bigging up the chances of the home nations, and particularly England. And then I always get disappointed. I know other people kind of have that. I'm going to go in feeling very pessimistic, thinking we'll get knocked out at every single game, and then I won't be too disappointed. Which kind of camp do you fall in, Ben?
I'm ever the optimist, and I am English, and obviously I will support England. But I always do have a bit of a sense of wanting the other home nations to do well. And I've seen lots of people saying, I could hear the England fans last night booing or cheering when Scotland had conceded and booing when they'd scored. And I can't ever get quite as emotional as some of the England fans around not wanting Scotland and Wales to do well. Obviously, if it came to a head-to-head, I would want England to win. Are you a diehard patriot, Dave?
I've a grandmother who is Scottish. So, I mean, when I figured out at, you know, kind of like the age of 30, I probably wasn't going to make it as an England international, I did hang on to the idea that I may be able to play for Scotland under the grandmother rule. And I think that maybe at, you know, kind of 44 years of age, I still might be able to, but it's gradually looking less and less likely. I'm kind of one of the, I'm not necessarily strange, but I want all the home nations to do well. There are a few times when I will actively boo another team, but I'll get onto which of those teams that would be. But if anyone hasn't guessed who's listening, this evening we are doing a football special. So we're looking at football and finance. Ben, before we introduce our guest for today, do you want to take us through a quick trip down memory lane of kind of like what football means to you and kind of who you support and things like that?
Wow, what does football mean to me? That's a very broad subject. Football has impacted a few areas of my life. I think initially playing, I played and used to play for a local side on Saturdays. And I did that right up till just after I got married. And it wasn't getting married that stopped me from doing it. It was when actually I joined First Intuition and realized we did lots of classes on Saturdays and I couldn't commit to continue playing. So I stopped. I've kind of dabbled with mates playing five-a-side on a Friday night since. So I do still play a bit. My daughters both play. So I now take quite an active role in going to watch both of them play. My eldest plays for a girls team at under 12s and they've done really well. They finished their season this week and finished third in their league, which is two places higher than last season and close at the top. My youngest plays for a mixed team at under 10s level. And I take probably more of an active role in going to watch her play and help with some of the coaching there. My earliest memories, now you've got me thinking, Dave. I am an East Anglia boy, born and bred. So my summers were spent with grandparents on the Suffolk coast. And so I've always affiliated toward Ipswich Town and used to go and watch them quite a bit when I was younger. I've always supported England. And I think being slightly younger than you, thinking back to some of my earliest memories, definitely Italian 90. And I guess a lot of people say this, don't they? Italian 90 was when it all really ignited for me, understanding England and tournament football. I can vividly remember being at a school disco when England played Cameroon in that tournament and that they managed to come back and win it. I can also remember being at a Cub camp in a tent, vivid memory this one, in the game that nobody ever wants to play in at the World Cup, the third and fourth place playoff where England had to play Italy. And I was a Boy Scout cub sitting in a tent with a radio listening to that one. So lots of memories, lots of way football has impacted on me. What about you, Dave? Being slightly older, you can take us back probably to the early 80s football.
I agree about that third, fourth place playoff game. It's a game that whenever it's played, and I know it's kind of come in and out of different tournaments, to me, it just seems like the worst idea ever, just to make two teams that are probably at their lowest ebb, having lost probably the biggest game of their careers, and then you force them to play another game afterwards when all they want to do is fly away home. I just think it's just a cruel way to make those teams end the tournament. But you're right. My I have a memory of my elder stepbrother collecting Spain 82 Panini stickers, and I remember the stickers being everywhere in our house. You said 1990 was the first World Cup that you really kind of got into. For me, it was Mexico 86. And you know, I remember everyone in my playground wanting to be Maradona until a certain game came along, and then no one wanted to be Maradona anymore. So, and that was, yeah, for me, those big tournaments, I always love when the whole nation kind of gets behind them. As a club supporter, though, I am a Derby County fan. And around the time, it's purely a family thing. I in my house, it was support Derby County or you're homeless. So there wasn't really a choice of who I supported. And we were in the third tier of English football when I first started supporting them. And it was, I lived in Hampshire, and we were going to lovely places kind of like Bournemouth and Swindon and Southampton when they were in those kind of leagues as well. And didn't really know any form of success in terms of club football. My uncles all remember the glory years of Clough in the 70s, but that was kind of a very distant memory at that point in time. And as I said earlier, one of the things that has kind of changed for me when I became an accountant was, well, one, I had to give up playing football in the same way you did when I started teaching. But when, as accountants, we think of businesses as organisations that are set out with an objective, usually to provide financial reward for the owners or for the shareholders. And we think about customers in a certain way. But for football, none of that seems to make sense, because if I'm a customer of any other business in the way that I'm a fan of Derby County, would I go to a pizza restaurant and sit down there and say, that pizza was awful? You know, would I go back the next week and then just start shouting at the chef to do a better job and go back there week after week after week? No, I just change and go somewhere else. But as a football fan, we can't do that. So it's a really strange relationship you've got from a customer perspective. And then from an owner's perspective, when I look at some of the work that our guest does and the information that our guest puts out, I can't believe that any of those football clubs are set up with any kind of profit motive behind them, you know, in the way that we traditionally think of businesses being run. So as an accountant, I've kind of got this kind of really conflicting ideas of what I think about when I think about football, because they're not normal, rational businesses in the way that we think of normal, rational businesses.
So you referenced our guest. I think it's about time we brought him on and got him to say hello to everybody. So I would like to welcome Kieran Maguire. Good evening, Kieran. Good
evening, guys. Thanks very much for the invite.
When we get a guest on the podcast, Kieran, we usually start off asking them to do a little bit of a backstory. Dave always says this is their first 5-10 minutes if they were having a Marvel superhero movie made about them. How did they get to the position of power that they are into today? So succinctly, what's your backstory, Kieran? How did you get into and start and then finish up where you are now?
Well, I qualified as a chartered accountant. Then I did the same job as you guys. I went into teaching I was working for what is now Kaplan for 14 years. And I had young family. I'd reached the stage where teaching two evenings a week and weekends wasn't really good from a family point of view. So I went to university. My son was diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome. So, you know, I wanted a job where I could be more free in terms of flexibility. Sorry, I've got something in my eye. I've been teaching in the public sector for 20 years, but I also moonlight doing other things. And one of the things that I've been working on is working for investment banks every summer, teaching their graduates Excel, finance, financial reporting from the perspective of bankers. And I happened to be teaching some fairly senior bankers down in Canary Wharf when the Glazer family acquired Manchester United. And the BBC phoned up the university and said, can anybody explain what a leveraged buyout is? And the university said, we've got this, one of our teachers, all he does is he talks about football in his lectures. And he seems to know something. He seems to be something to do with the banks as well. So on the back of that, I went in and did quite a bit of media work. And then things just went from there. I was recruited by the University of Liverpool, who have a football MBA course to run the finance side, because nobody likes teaching accounting and football apart from me. And on the back of that, things have just snowballed. I now do a podcast with a stand-up comedian, Kevin Day, twice a week. That's proved to be quite popular. Over the course of the last 6 months, I've appeared before Parliament on four occasions in respect of football finance, gambling and sport, the government's fan-led review. And rightly or wrongly, people seem to ask me questions. So about 4 or 5 weeks ago, I was sitting on a Friday evening with my wife, and there's a phone call, and it'd been quite a busy day because football can be a bit crazy at times. It'd been quite a busy day. My wife has said, right, it's 8 o'clock. You've not had your dinner yet. If anybody else phones, tell them to go away. And it was former Prime Minister Gordon Brown, who was appearing on television the following day in respect of football, and he wanted some data. So I spent an hour talking to a former Prime Minister who, to be fair, gave me a good grilling. You know, he certainly knew how the numbers fitted out together. So that's where I am at present. I've got probably the easiest job in the country, in that I teach something that people want to learn, and I get the opportunity to go on television and radio, and I write for newspapers such as The Times and The Mail and The Independent, just for fun. So it's a glorified hobby, which has taken over my life. If I'm honest, the number of hours I have to put into it each week is ludicrous. But as I keep telling my wife, it's not a real job.
Super, super excited to hear that. And I can hear the passion. Something myself and Dave can definitely empathize with is the love of teaching and teaching accounting. But then if you can frame that around football, I think that just feels like a match made in heaven.
Yes. I've done all of my teaching life has been in Manchester and Liverpool, which are two huge football cities. So I've always used football accounts as a Trojan horse to teach conventional accounting. So if you can frame something from a football perspective, and if you say to students, well, you know, let's take a look at the debts of this club. What does this mean for the future? Can we model this forwards? And they'll all pile in. So I'm very, very lucky because the quality of the work that's produced by my students is ridiculously high. I set them a 4,000 word assignment at university last semester, and I had students phoning up to complain that 4,000 words wasn't enough. Now, when was the last time you had a student who said, any chance of doing a bit more on this piece of work? So I am, I've just fallen on my feet, and I'm very unpopular with some football clubs because they historically have had nobody analysing their accounts. I've got a spreadsheet which has got 210 tabs, one for every football league club, all of the Scottish clubs, all of the non-league clubs, then the history of the Premier League going back to 1992. If my house goes on fire, I run in, collect the laptop first, which contains my spreadsheet, take that outside, make sure it's safe, and then I'd come back and rescue my wife and dog. You know, it's that important to me.
And I guess football must be the gift that keeps on giving. Some of the things I can think of that appear in the financial context and the accounts of football clubs, I'm talking amortization, I'm thinking related party transactions, I'm thinking going concern statements, I'm thinking that there must be lots around cash flow and forecasting. And it's probably why SEMA actually picked a football club for their final case study exam back in 2015. For anybody that studies SEMA, you'll know, but if you don't, the SEMA syllabus has a case study exam at the end of every level, and the strategic case is the final one. So this is the final exam for those SEMA students. And they always release a pre-seen scenario of a business context that the exam's going to be framed around, and students need to go away and understand. And they picked a football club, presumably because there is just so much that you can talk around that brings the stuff that we sometimes says is quite boring accounting really to life.
Yes, I've got a very devoted Twitter following, for whom the word amortization is now a standing joke, and you know, the fact that people have taken an interest in it from a perspective of self-interest, but also from a perspective of they want to see what their rival clubs are doing as well. So the intrigue that people have with, we've seen issues in terms of revenue recognition over the course of the last 12 to 15 months because the football season was delayed. There were existing contracts. What do you do with rebates, which are contractually obliged to pay? What happens when you sign a player for £40 million and 12 months later, everybody says, he's rubbish. So we move into the world of impairment. How do you work out the impairment value of a football? And what we are seeing is an awful lot of creative accounting, acceleration and deceleration of both revenues and costs in order to hit profit targets, which are set by external bodies. The willingness of some owners to underwrite losses to the nth degree. So we've just had the Champions League final between Manchester City and Chelsea. What's also unique about those two clubs when they played each other, those two clubs have made the biggest losses in the history of the Premier League since it started. So under any other business model, you would say Manchester City and Chelsea are poorly run. Manchester City won the Premier League and the League Cup. Chelsea got to the FA Cup final and they won the Champions League. Is there anybody complaining about the financial state of those clubs at the Etihad or at Stamford Bridge? The answer is no. The fans love the owners. The owners love the club. It's an intriguing industry. And I've been working on it now for quite a few years. And the more you dig into it, the more crazy it becomes. And I know David's a Derby County fan, but I don't want to embarrass you too much, David, but a few years ago, your club recruited the mother of one of the players as an agent and paid her £700,000 a year. She's got no qualifications whatsoever. You know, so yeah, I'll do a job for which I've got no qualifications to £700,000 a year. Why did they do that? It's because under the football rules, academy costs, and this was deemed to be an academy cost because it was scouting for youth players, don't count towards your football losses, your financial fair play losses. And also, you dig a little bit further, and for this particular player they were signing, some other players at the club had clauses in their contracts. If somebody joins and is on a higher salary than me, I get an automatic pay rise. So by paying the player's mother £700,000, the club didn't have to go and pay that money. And things of this nature, you listen to them and I read about them and I have to double check and treble check. One club is sponsored by a taxi company, which is owned by the club owner, that doesn't itself own any taxis. Where's the sense in that? It's football. It's crazy. It's as you were saying earlier, it's the gift that keeps on giving. And it allows me to pretend to do a proper job when all I'm doing is looking at football club accounts.
I love that. So a football club is sponsored by a taxi company that doesn't own any cars. I mean, that just reminds me of Pablo Escobar. And, you know, having one of the top 10 largest companies on the planet, which was his taxi firm, which people may have been used to launder ill-gotten gains through. That's just absolutely nuts. I don't know where to start with something like that. It's just absolutely crazy.
And the stories never stop as well. You know, this year we've had the European Super League, which effectively brought the country to a halt. You know, in the middle of a pandemic, England stopped for the 36, 48 hours, and we got rid of this monstrosity as football fans, but it was on every single news channel. And this is not complaining, because it's always better to be too busy than too quiet. I was starting at 5 o'clock in the morning on one radio station, and I put up my schedule of radio stations that day, and I finished at midnight. And it was just 18 hours of interviews. Things were developing minute by minute. But you, I think you alluded to it earlier, that football doesn't play by the rules of the rest of business, in the sense that most companies have broadly a profit maximization objective. And what we see in the world of football is that we have a meeting of minds. We now have commodity hedge funds. We've got private equity companies who have come into the game, who are trying to make money out of it. And then we've got the likes of Roman Abramovich, who says, here's a check for £250 million. Go and have some fun and sign some players. How do those two business models compete? And this leads to the intrigue and the inconsistencies within the game, because we've actually got, it's like a set of scales. You've got sporting objective, and then you've got financial common sense. And the two don't operate consistently with each other.
There's a couple of bits I can pick up on there. One was, I mentioned the SEMA case study, and actually they had the business of the football club making a loss. And I guess they had to do that just to fit in with the vast majority of clubs publishing accounts. But actually it was quite a surprise for students to see a loss, because usually in a case study, the business is healthy and making a profit. And also the dawning realization that they think these big brands, these global names, successful organizations would actually be publishing in a set of accounts a loss-making P&L and a balance sheet that's probably not as healthy as we expect. The other one, and this is where I really would like to ask you, Kieran, one of the things we talk about lots in class is stakeholder management. It's front and center in lots of the syllabuses. You might know the Mendelow's matrix, where we get students to think about the power and the influence and the care that stakeholders might have in the organization. Did those big six UK clubs really not consider the wider stakeholder group and not preempt the backlash that the nation threw at them over the couple of days after the announcement?
No, because there was a complete breakdown of understanding. Because the owners thought these clubs can make more money, therefore the fans will buy into this. They don't have an understanding of football. But then let's take a look at the owners of the six clubs in the Premier League who are involved. We've got Roman Abramovich, who's a Russian oligarch. We've got Sheikh Mansour, who is a state-owned oil and gas beneficiary. We've got the Glazer family from Florida, who come from a background of franchise sport, which is very profitable. So they said, well, let's transplant that model to Europe. So they thought, well, Manchester United fans, even if 50,000 Manchester United fans don't like it, we'll find another 50,000. Manchester United's got hundreds of millions of fans. So they didn't see it as being a problem. It was a complete lack of understanding. The biggest investors in football are not the owners. They are not the executives. They are the fans, because as David was saying earlier, with regards to pizzas, with football, you get brand loyalty that every other industry on the planet would give their right arm for. Even, you know, even sort of goods which are sort of price inelastic, which have some addictive qualities, you know, people switch from brands of cigarettes, they switch from brands of alcohol if the price differential is right. I teach at the University of Liverpool. If Manchester United offered people from the COP free season tickets for 3 years for Old Trafford, they just turn them away. So this incredible brand loyalty that people have, and this lifelong investment. You know, I've been watching football since the age of 8 or 9. I think. What are you sort of? I know you're based in East Anglia. Way. I mean, I used to live in Chelmsford, and I used to go and watch Chelmsford City when I was a kid, and then I moved to Brighton at the age of 11. So I've been watching Brighton now for 50 years, Football is so dumb, and football fans are so dumb, that 18 months ago, I was down here for a match. I phoned up my wife and said to her, because I lived in Manchester. I said, I'm getting fed up, because at the end of every match on a Saturday, I have to run from the stadium to the train station, get a train to London, to try to make sure I get the last train up to Manchester on a Saturday night. And this means I can't have a chat about the match with my friends after the game. Let's move house down to Brighton. So that's what we've done. So to allow me to chat to my friends after a football game on a Saturday, I now commute from Brighton to Liverpool to go to work. And for me, that's a perfectly logical thing to do. And when I talk to other football fans, they say, yeah, if you can do it, do it. And I talk to people that don't get football, and they think I'm stark raving mad.
So not just the owners of football clubs, but the fans of football clubs are completely irrational to the outside world in their decision-making process because of their motives of loving a club.
But is it irrational from that perspective? Because if you look at it from an enjoyment per pound level, if I was to list the top 10 things that have happened to me in my life, probably 6 of them would involve my football team. So when something can bring you so much joy, then the cost, you know, the financial cost, the time cost, the emotional cost that goes into it, you are actually making rational decisions, because the rewards, they might not be very often, because I support Brighton, I don't support a big football club. They might not occur very often, but the shared experiences, the shared memories that I have with people that I've known since the age of 11, you cannot put a financial price on them.
Something that's being echoed in the chat box by Mark, who's an Oldham Athletic fan. So he hasn't seen too many glory days in his 48 years of supporting the club.
Well, I've played at Boundary Park. In fact, I scored a goal for a friendly match at Boundary Park for Brighton versus Oldham. So this was being mid-80s when they had the plastic pitch. I scored in the last minute, which gave us victory. I ran 90 yards to the other end of the pitch because the match had kicked off at 1 o'clock. To celebrate in front of the Brighton fans, only to find out it had been disallowed for offside. Devastated.
We're mentioning lots of historic clubs: Oldham, Brighton, Derby, Ipswich. Draws me to a point I want to get your thoughts on. Fairness within football. Obviously, the revenue numbers are massive for the bigger clubs, not so massive for some of the traditionally bigger clubs that now find themselves down the lower leagues. Do you think the English football system is fair on the clubs?
You have to define fair. At present, the so-called Big Six clubs of the Premier League, they average revenues of £499 million a year. The other clubs in the Premier League, they average revenues of £146 million. Now, in the world of football, if you do a correlation analysis, there is a close correlation between wages and transfer fees paid and success. So would we be better with an American NFL style of game where revenues are centralized and distributed relatively evenly between clubs? That would increase sporting uncertainty. That would increase the likes of Derby County, Aston Villa, Leeds, Everton, West Ham, Brighton, Palace, whoever it's going to be, winning trophies. So some people say, well, that would be really good, and what the system we have is unfair. The alternative view is to say, well, hold on, Manchester United, Liverpool, Chelsea, these are global brands, just as Apple is a global brand, just as BMW is a global brand, and therefore they deserve the extra revenue and the rewards that come with it. So I think it's a really interesting philosophical discussion as to the what is the purpose of football as a professional sport in terms of what are realistic revenue distribution models. Presently, we have clubs such as Manchester United who generate 20 times as much commercial revenues as the likes of Watford and Burnley towards the bottom of the Premier League, but they only get around about 2.5 times the amount of TV revenue. So have we actually made some steps towards making the game fairer? It could be argued that that is the case, and that's partly driven the success of the Premier League in that if you compare the Premier League to other divisions in European sport, we know realistically Bayern Munich are going to win the German League, Juventus are going to win the Italian League, Barcelona or Real Madrid. Now, I know 2020-21 has been slightly different, but I think COVID might be a contributory factor. I think we've actually got a reasonable model. It could be distributed on a more egalitarian basis, but is that itself fair? Because should Burnley be deserving of having broadly the same amount of money as Liverpool?
And I think on a personal level, that really gets to the nub of the Big Six and the breakaway European Super League, doesn't it? I don't think anyone begrudges those six clubs the success they get because they are great clubs. I think the thing that people really didn't like was the fact they were saying we're going to make this almost a closed shop and say the others can't ever get to where we are. As an Ipswich Town fan in League One, I live on the hope that in theory we're only promotion from the Championship, promotion to the Premier League, three seasons away, we could be in the Champions League. Now we could be. Now we know they won't be. But that dream still exists for the regular football fan, Kieran. And I guess that was the big thing that the Big Six making this announcement really said, we're going to make this more of a closed shop.
Yes. They said, you know, we've got £350 million more than all of the other clubs in the Premier League. That's not enough. We are greedy. We want more. And Liverpool didn't want to, the worry of, you know, if we think about what happened in the Premier League this season, Liverpool went into the final game of the season not knowing whether or not they'd be in the Premier League next season. Can we get rid of that problem? Yes, we can. We'll make it our own competition. And that ethos comes from the American franchise model that we see in the NFL, the NBA, the NHL, and so on, where you pay a franchise fee and you get those closed division benefits of guaranteed matchday income, guaranteed TV and commercial revenues, wage caps, because there's nowhere else for the players to go. You know, people talk to me, and I think one of the questions on the chat was, why are footballers paid so much? Well, I don't think they are, personally. If you take a look at the club with the biggest wage bill in English football, which is Manchester City, the wage bill last season, £362 million. That's less than a gambling company, Bet365, pay their chief executive. And Manchester City bring far more joy than gambling companies do. So are those wages overstated? It's a talent industry. And then I say to myself, well, if we're going to reduce the players' wages, where else is the money going to go? Because they're not going to reduce ticket prices. I can guarantee you this. And they're not going to say to the TV companies, well, wow, wage bill has gone down, so therefore you don't have to give us so much money, so therefore you can go and cut your subscription fees. The money is simply going to go to the owners, and the owners are already billionaires. So I'd rather money go to millionaires than billionaires.
Players' wages is always going to be an emotive subject. And I wonder if it's more to do with the psychology of thinking they're doing things that the likes of me and you would willingly do voluntarily on a Saturday and actually pay a match subscription to kind of play for your local team, as opposed to get paid the thousands of pounds a week.
But I think sometimes it's that you're looking at the 1-3% of players. You know, if you're actually looking at the majority of footballers who are playing, they're not earning that amount of money. I mean, you know, if you look at, you know, Kieran, I'm just up the road from Chelmsford, and you know, if Chelmsford City could afford to pay players, I'm sure they would. But the players that are playing there are not doing it for the financial rewards. You know, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, that if you looked at the third and the fourth tier of English football, I'm pretty sure that the players there are not doing it for the massive financial rewards that Northampton Town could give them.
Yeah, I mean, I do a wages analysis. And I'm fortunate enough to know quite a few people in the football game. Not that I've ever sought it, but you know, rightly or wrongly, if you are constantly quoting numbers, you get a reputation, both good and bad. So the average wage in League Two is probably around about £80,000-£85,000 a year for a career, which is going to end 32. In League Two, sorry, in League One, it's probably around about 120,000. And you're constantly on 1 and 2 year contracts, and you are one bad tackle away from the end of your career. And if you think about the jobs that we do, you know, I started teaching in the 80s, started doing tuition in the 80s. I knew at the time I had a job realistically for life. So footballers, it is a short career. The average professional's career lasts 7 years, because yes, we know at the elite end they'll probably go on for longer, but there's many people that come into the game and they end up on a Bosman at the age of 26-27. Nobody else will give them a full-time contract, and they drop into non-league, and all of a sudden they're trying to find other jobs. So footballers' wages, and I think the envy of footballers' wages, is a really interesting sociological and anthropological issue, because it's communicated in such a way from the media that these people don't deserve it, whereas people, they don't talk about how much media owners earn in their 60s, 70s, 80s and 90s. So there does appear to be a diversionary tactic to try to imply that these young athletes, both men and women, because I was asked a question last week, what's the highest paid player in women's football? And my understanding, having done a wee bit of research, is the highest paid player is on £300,000 a year, which for a sport which is still in a startup phase is fantastic. But these people bring lots of enjoyment. They bring far more enjoyment than I do as an accountant. So why shouldn't they have the money?
The point you make about the length of the career is a good one, and one that we've seen. A number of footballers are actually doing distance learning courses with us to get their AAT qualification, thinking, well, it's something that's stable. It occupies a bit of time, because one thing footballers probably have on their hands when they're not playing and training is a bit of time to do some study. And being financially savvy and wise is going to be a good thing for them for their current situation, but also might provide a bit of a stable income when they hang up their boots. And we've got ladies footballers and men's footballers doing courses with us actively at the moment. I guess the big wages, though, that grab the headlines are the likes of Cristiano Ronaldo, and whether he will be returning to the Premier League in future, we'll wait and see. But do you think those massive, massive superstars have got too much power and influence potentially over the clubs that they're looking to negotiate with and sign contracts with?
Well, they can only play for one club at any one time. And they are global brands in their own right. If we take a look at Cristiano Ronaldo, for example, he has more Instagram followers than all of the Premier League clubs put together. So people are interested in celebrity. There are other people who are giants of their own industries in other sports. So you know, you think of the likes of Roger Federer in tennis and Tiger Woods, Lewis Hamilton, they earn as much money or not, or if not more, sorry, or similar to Cristiano Ronaldo. So it always intrigues me. Why is there this constant drip that other parts of the entertainment industry, you know, you see movie stars picking up $30-40 million for a single film. Nobody seems to mind that. And I've never come out of a film, whereas I have come out of football and said, well, I'm not going again. The amount of money they earn is far too much. And it just ruins the game for me. I didn't come out of Toy Story 2 saying, well, I would have liked a lot more if Tom Hanks hadn't been paid so much for playing the part of Woody. So this is a really weird scenario that we have in terms of our relationship with the game. And perhaps it is to do with the fact that we do love, if you're a football fan, you do love the game and you have this romantic notion, this Corinthian notion of everybody's doing it for the right reasons. Whereas if I'm honest, if another university comes along and offers me £700,000 a year, you won't be able to see me. I'll be running so fast down the M6 to sign up for whoever it is. So why shouldn't footballers do the same?
I think, obviously, we're in the midst of the Euros. It would be remiss of us not to quickly mention England. Something that I really like during these big world and European tournaments is watching football with the family. And it's the very rare times that my wife will actually sit with me and watch a game of football. She's convinced that Tyrone Mings is still a mortgage consultant. They've mentioned it in the commentary a few times. And I think she thinks, bless her, he goes off at half time and has to go and deal with someone's annuity just to get them signed up for their next mortgage. But a question I had, do footballers get paid for playing for their national sides in things like the Euros? Are they on a separate contract for that, aside from their club contract?
Yes, that they are. They are paid by the Football Association, and all of the England players waive their fees, and those fees are given to charity. So there is a set fee per match, and the England team have decided they don't want that. On top of the match fee, there will be bonuses for winning the European Championship, should that be the case. I think it's going to be around about 30 million euro is going to be the prize for the club or for the nation that wins. That money, a proportion of that will go to players. And again, looking at it from our perspective, from, you know, as tutors, the players have got image rights companies into which some of that money will go. Sometimes that's located offshore. That money, the directors of that company, it could be the player, it could be the players, could be the player's family. Of course, that will get taxed at 19% under corporation tax rules as opposed to 45%. So there's the opportunity for us to look at football through a variety of lenses from the world of finance and financial planning. From football, I think is really good. And I'm absolutely delighted to hear that you've got some people who are in the industry who are taking their AAT. The PFA, the Professional Footballers Association, is actually, whilst it gets headlines sometimes for the wrong reasons, it really encourages its members to go down the education route and the post-career route. And it's often, it will often subsidise the fees that they are paying to support its members.
I mean, something that I would just note about players is that for all the negativity that we hear, I'm fortunate enough to know the mother of a Premier League footballer. And when she tells me about the amount of charity and the amount of community work that they do as part of their role as a player, I think that's something that is never, ever mentioned. And if I look back into last year and the pandemic, and if I had to name my kind of top five heroes of last year, I would struggle to think of someone. I would struggle to think of anyone that did more than Marcus Rashford did in terms of the work that he did to help people that really needed it last year. And as far as I'm concerned, he earns absolutely every penny and deserves more than he gets for the work that he did for all of the people out there that were really just struggling to put food on their tables. Likewise, you could say the same with the work that Raheem Sterling does as well. There are some really fine individuals that do a huge amount of community and charity work that doesn't get mentioned when you read the news headlines. And I think that's something that I've treated rather unfairly by the press. And it is envy. And you're right, actors and musicians and to a certain extent, politicians that are earning huge amounts of money on the side don't get the same flack that we give to, in essence, it's people that happen to be brilliant at something that we love that are making the best out of it, which I would encourage anyone to do anyway. If you're talented, make the best of your talents. It just seems absolutely crazy how we vilify people for the fact that they are offered the money by a football club to do something that I would love to do.
Yeah. No football club has been forced to pay a footballer extra funds and to renew a contract or to sign them. Every football owner has gone into those negotiations with free will. So if they choose to pay them a large sum of money, then that's what they felt that they were worth. And it's market forces. It's supply and demand. And again, it goes back to basic economics. So it's a strange subject because I'm fortunate now that I've got to know quite a few footballers because I teach for an organisation called the League Managers Association. So these are former footballers a lot of the time, or people who are towards the end of their career and they're thinking of going into the management game. And so I've taught the likes of Tony Adams, who used to be the England captain, Joe Jordan, who was famous playing for Scotland, and many others. And they are just young men, just like the people that, young men and often young women now, because we're getting far more diversity in terms of management with the rise of women's football. And they want to be the best that they can within their chosen profession, just to a certain extent. Isn't that what we want to do ourselves? And that we see them as footballers, but they're not. They're brothers, they're sisters, they're mums and dads, they're best mates, they're people that do suffer from depression. There are people, they are at times, they are absolutely petrified at 5 to 3 to go out to stand before 30,000 people. We don't know what that's like. If I've got a class of more than 40, I start to get a bit twitchy. But they are having to perform at the elite level. They know that people are going to be hanging on to their every word, but they've still got the same things to do that we have. Yeah, they still got to go and do the groceries, pay the mortgage, and so on and so forth. So I've learned, I've learned many things from since becoming part of the industry, and I'm very much a sort of, in the galaxy of football, I'm somewhere near Neptune, in terms of how central I am. I'm far off it, but I have got to know a lot of people in the industry. And what you realise is that what they have in common with you and I is far, far greater than what they have, which is different.
Really interesting point and something that I think we all lose sight of when we see them on the telly. We glorify them, but they are people just like me and you. Kieran, as always, we are up against the clock and it is nearly 7 o'clock and I've got to shoot in a moment to go and teach a spreadsheets class. Oh. Which is going to be exciting, but nowhere near as exciting as talking about football. Thank you so much for coming on. It has been very, very interesting linking up stuff that we talk about in the classroom on a regular basis to the world of football. I think is fantastic. I will leave Dave in a minute to do a final close down. But all I will say is we are shirt sponsors for Cambridge City ladies football team, who play in the South East Division One of the National League. We are awaiting their fixtures. Their season this year was curtailed. COVID put pay to it and it was just ended. But when we get the fixture list through, I will ping you an email to see if we can get you along to a game. Or cool. If you're playing in your neck of the woods down south, because they venture into London occasionally, we'll see if we can hook up a match and you can come and meet Becca, their captain, who's an ACCA qualified now, but she was one of our students all the way through. And she's a fantastic centre-back.
Brilliant. Yeah, thank you very much. That'd be absolutely cosmic.
Cool. Yeah. Dave, I will hand over to you to close down the podcast and I will disappear off to my spreadsheets class.
So, yeah, from me, thank you so much, Kieran, for being guest. I've absolutely loved the last hour and I'm pretty confident I could be here for another 3 hours just finding out more about all of the knowledge you've got about football finance. But the thing I really want to just finish on before we sign off is something you said right at the beginning, where you talked about your work in kind of mixing that blend of teaching and football, and saying that you would do the job even if you weren't paid for it, because it's something that you love. And I know from my perspective, I've always felt that I'm kind of like a performer but I'm a performer that can't sing, can't act, can't play any kind of musical instrument, can't tell a joke and be funny. But somehow I found myself in a role where I get to perform every day. And I love that performance of when I'm teaching. And in terms of people that are listening to this or watching this, a career in finance enables you to go in so many different directions. It's led to me to be able to perform about finance. It's led to you being able to work in a world that mixes the sport you love with finance within it. And I tell everyone that every business, every walk of life you go into, there is a need for someone to be there to actually look at the finances. So whether you love music, whether you love film, whether you love fashion, whether you love food, whether for some reason you like mass producing motor vehicles, there is a finance role there. And, you know, for me, it's, you know, I feel the same way you do. I do a job that I love, that I would do if I didn't get paid for it. You know, it's something that I really enjoy doing. And I really hope that everyone listening can find something that they love as much as I do, as much as you do, that really satisfies them. That's ultimately what we should be looking for in our careers. So I think on that note, I'm going to sign off. We will hopefully see some of you again live next week. If you're listening whilst going for a walk with your dogs, thank you so much for choosing to subscribe and choosing to listen. Hopefully we'll get to see you in the next few weeks, and we'll be back very, very soon with more guests and hopefully more news from the world of accountants.
Thank you very much for the invite.